You're at the end of the agenda. I think Susan Lane's going to come get you.
Okay.
There you go. Good afternoon. I'll call to order meeting the State Government Budget Division for Wednesday, March 5, 2008. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum. We do have three bills on our agenda today. Before we get to the interagency agreement presentation by the governor's office, the first bill is Senate File 1128 from Senator Erickson Ropes. This is a bill that actually apparently was heard in the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee. And it looks like it got its second reading, so it must have come back off of the floor to have a look at the fiscal issues, as I'm looking at the history here. Senator Erickson Ropes, welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We worked on this bill last year, and it passed through Senator Metzen's committee, and we're bringing it back then from last session, and we have an amendment.
Okay, the amendment's being passed out right now. Okay. And as it's being passed out, do you have a copy of it, Senator Erickson Ropes?
I do.
Okay. Can somebody describe what the amendment? Well, why don't you describe what the bill is, and then we'll have to describe, because we can't accept this as an author's amendment. It's already been to another committee. So describe generally what the bill is, and then we can take a look at what the amendment does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been working with the Alzheimer's Association, AARP, and the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. And what this bill does is expand the number of people that an employee is able to use his sick leave benefit for. Currently, for example, an employee is able to use sick time for themselves or their spouse or their child. And as we have an aging population that's growing and growing, and many of us are moving into this age group where we have aging parents and we still have children, we are very interested in providing support for our parents. And so we would just like the opportunity to use sick days as they exist right now within the context of the parameters that are already existing. If you need to take your parent to see the doctor because they're getting cancer treatments or they're failing and they have Alzheimer's issues, that you should be able to use your sick leave days for your parent as well as yourself or your spouse or your child. So we're just expanding the number of people that you would be able to take your sick leave for, and frankly, that's the bill.
And then what does the A1 amendment do? I don't know, either Council or Senator Erickson Ropes, what can describe what the A1 amendment does.
Okay. We'll have Heidi Holte from AARP talk to you a little bit about the amendment and why the amendment is before you.
Oh, and could we get your name again, please?
Sure.
Identify yourself for the record, yeah.
I'm Heidi Holste with AARP.
How do you spell your last name?
H-O-L-S-T-E.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
As Senator Erickson Ropes said, the bill as drafted allows for an expansion of who you can legally use your sick leave for, and that includes, under current law, it's yourself or your sick or injured child. With the language as written, there was almost an $11 million fiscal note per year that the Department of Employee Relations assigned to this bill. With this amendment, we are saying that the section of law that we're trying to pass only applies to employers that do not already have policies or a provision in a labor agreement in place that authorizes the use of sick leave for a spouse, sibling, parent, grandparent, or step-parent. So in effect, the state of Minnesota has a labor agreement with their employees that allows for some use of sick time, and so it eliminates the fiscal note from the state.
Okay, and we do have a fiscal note that's been prepared. It's my understanding that the fiscal note reflects assumes adoption of the A1. It says do or assumes the one. It says 1A amendment to this bill. So
that's correct, Mr. Chair. If the amendment is adopted, The fiscal note from Dewar, and I believe there's a rep from Dewar here, but the fiscal note drops from the $11 million impact to zero.
Okay. Is Dewar here that we can hear from them? And let me stress to the people who are here on this bill, the policy issues were discussed last year in the
Senator Metzen.
Well, in the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee. This is not a policy committee. This is a budget division. So we have to look at the budget issues. We assume that the policy has been approved by the appropriate policy committee. So whether it's a good idea or a bad idea overall is not our focus. We are looking at what the cost is either to the state or to the local governments or whatever. That is our focus here. So that's what we need to look at in this budget division. So welcome to the budget division. We need you to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner from the Department of Employee Relations. I also serve as the state labor negotiator.
Okay. And apparently adoption of the A1 amendment would remove any cost to the state. Is that correct?
That is correct,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Now, do we have any idea whether or not there'd be any effect on local governments if by adopting this?
Mr. Chair, I do not. I can just speak anecdotally. I do know that with respect to this type of benefit, that there are a lot of employers out there that have a negotiated benefit in their collective bargaining agreement on the use of sick leave for other people. And I would presume, similar to the state, that there are provisions like what our collective bargaining contains in other public sector jurisdictions.
Yes.
Okay. Any questions, Mr. Larson? Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't understand why there would be an impact just with this language, because if the state already has these agreements through their unions, either way, wouldn't the dollars be accounted for?
Well, Mr. Larson?
Chair, Senator Olsen, the $11 million was a calculation that we came up with regard to the overtime costs that would be attributable to the replacement employee. The way the language is written, that an employee would be able to use the sick leave in the same manner as if it was for sick leave for themselves. What we did was we calculated our correctional facilities and our DHS facilities and our veterans' homes, and oftentimes we are running at just the bare minimum staffing pattern. So if someone does call in sick, which they can do for themselves, that oftentimes that triggers overtime costs for us. And so that's how we came up with that. What we actually did was we did an analysis of our 24/7 facilities and factored in an additional, I think we used either 2 days or 3 days. I have to apologize. It's been a while since I looked at. It was either 2 or 3 days, and we said add 3 days and the impact that this has with regard to overtime, and that was the cost that we came up with. So it's not the replacement time. This is actual overtime costs.
Follow-up, if I may.
Senator Olsen.
So what is it in place in the agreements then that they would still be able to do this, is my understanding, or wouldn't they be able to do that?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, they would. We have other provisions. We have unpaid elder care leave. We do have other instances. We have, for example, you can use up to 24 hours of sick leave a year to take your parents to doctor's appointments and so on, but we get a 14-day notice for those, which then allows us to adjust the schedule of other employees, so it will avoid the overtime.
Thank you.
Sir Roebling, did you have a question too? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, does this only apply to government employees, or is this for all private employers as well?
I'm not sure. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, my understanding is this would be a bill for the state of Minnesota, and that would include all employers.
All employers.
However,
okay.
I would just point to the fact that in law, there's already a lot of definition. For example, sick leave, as defined in current law, is only limited to employees who are, or employers with 21 people or more at the same site. So we're not talking about businesses that may have two employees or five. There's a lot of current state law already that would direct this piece at larger employers.
Perhaps again, the Senate Counsel fill us in on who the current law affects and who this proposed bill would affect. Mr. Botter?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ropes is correct. The definitions that apply to this, because it's coded in Chapter 181, Section 9413, are found in Section 181.940, and employer is defined to mean a person or entity that employs 21 or more employees. And then there are some other provisions attached to that, and the term includes an individual, corporation, partnership, association, nonprofit, et cetera, very comprehensive. And then there are limitations on who is an employee. You have to have worked at least 12 consecutive months, and then I think it's an average number of hours per week equal to half time in essence. So that's the gist of it, and it does apply to all. It's a statewide application.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on the A1 amendment? Anybody else who wants to be heard? Is there somebody who wants to? Sarah Erickson Ropes? Okay. Yep. Does somebody want to move the A1 amendment?
I'd like to.
Sarah Olsen moves the A1 amendment. Discussion on the A1 amendment. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Senator Erickson Ropes, did you have anybody else who wants to testify on the bill? And again, we're honing on the budget process. I mean, I guess it's fair game if the budget division members want to, probe the policy to understand it better. That's obviously fair. But we're not here for public testimony on the policy side. We're honing in on the budget issue. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for clarifying that. That is appreciated, I'm sure, for people watching this process. I would like to add additionally, as far as the expenses to local government go, we've heard from Doer, and we do have verbal confirmation from the Association of Minnesota Counties. Joe Matthew called in and said they do not have any objection to this bill. So if you're concerned about impact on a county level.
I believe we do have a process to get sort of a local impact request. I believe that's been done, but we don't have it available today. If the bill, of course, is within the Finance Committee, so they presumably would have it by any time that the Finance Committee would consider this bill. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to testify on the bill, either for it or against it? Again, discussing the budgetary aspects. We do have somebody coming forward, so welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And I believe my comments are of the fiscal nature.
Okay.
We at the League just want to be on record stating that we think this is a pretty significant expansion to the current definition of sick leave, especially from a fiscal aspect on how it would play out at the local level in terms of cities being employers. As you might guess, we have cities all over the board with both paid time off policies, which wouldn't be really affected under this bill. And then we have those cities that still have a sick time and vacation time policy. And just for the record, we did hear from quite a few cities just in the last week on this provision and on this bill about how they would be affected at the local level. Just to add, for a lot of our cities, they stated that this is one of those negotiated benefits, if you will, with their employee groups, and they looked at this as a real infringement on that local decision-making process that takes place. I'll stand for any questions.
Okay. Question?
Mr. Chair, Ms. O'Rourke, but these are actually earned benefits, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Any other questions? Is there anybody else who wants to be heard on the bill and, again, discussing the fiscal aspects? Mr. Carlson, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I'm sorry to disagree with the statewide association, but this does, in fact, have impact on counties and a fiscal impact. My association consists of 13 of the larger counties in the state. It does not consist of Ramsey or Hennepin County, but they do participate in our human resources committee. And I did survey them over the past couple days, and several of them responded that this will directly affect their sick leave policies and consequently their expenditures. The amendment has placed before you, I read it, will only exempt those entities that have a collective bargaining agreement that provides for the use of sick leave for every one of those specified individuals, a spouse, a sibling, a parent, a grandparent, or a step-parent. The counties of Ramsey, Carver, Olmsted, Winona, and Washington, most for all their employees, Washington County for some of their employees, would not fall under this exception and consequently would be subject to the broader provisions of the bill. I think is should be obvious to the committee. The work still has to be done by the employees who would be absent by this. So the employer is faced with either granting overtime to other employees to fill in for the work that's not accomplished due to the absence of the benefited individual, or getting temps. In addition, some of the counties self-insure for short-term disability purposes. And the way it works right now is you would exhaust your sick leave first and then utilize any short-term disability. Because this bears the possibility of reducing the amount of sick leave available to an employee who may subsequently use short-term disability, that also would increase the cost to the employer in those situations. So I concur with the representative of the League of Minnesota Counties. This does have substantial concern and fiscal impact at the local government level, and we ask at this time, particularly since I don't think anybody's naive here, all of us are going to be facing cuts because of the state's budget deficit, that this mandate not be placed on us at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer.
Well, it does seem to me, though, I mean, we've got nearly 3,500 bills as of today that were introduced from last year into this year, and there's a lot of stuff going on. This is a bill that was not only introduced last year, but it was heard and actually got to the Senate floor last year. We obviously didn't take it up for a vote, so it was returned. Who was it sent back to at the end of the session? I don't know. Did Senator Metzen get the bill back then, or how was this bill before? So it got to a second reading, so it was on the Senate floor. What happened? What happened? Where did the bill go from there? So,
Mr. Chair, members, it did make it. It did pass to the Senate floor, and then the fiscal note issue, and then the fiscal note was assigned, and so it had to be recalled back to the Finance Committee.
And it was sent to the Finance Committee, which is why we have it here. But you know, it's been, I think, nearly a year since this issue's been out there. So, you know, it'd be kind of nice if we, you know, got a handle on what the costs are. We've apparently addressed the state costs. If there's other costs, people have had an opportunity, I think, to have, you know, gotten some information on this one. Discussion. I mean, is there anybody else who wants to be heard on? Mr. Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if employees don't typically use their sick leave, is it a use it or lose it, or especially with the public employees, does theirs accumulate and then have a payment at the end of their employment, or would we necessarily still be paying for some of these sick leave days if they're not used?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, that depends from employer to employer and upon the collective bargaining agreement. In most instances that I'm familiar with, there is partial liquidation allowed of unused vacation and or sick leave. It's not 100% trade-off. But again, it varies from employer to employer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, I would agree with that. That's for the most part, a negotiated item. So it's hard to make a blanket statement about that. But one fact that I'd like the committee to consider, that maybe has something to do with policy, but also the fiscal impact is in many of our committees, and I'm sure you are as well, we're looking at cost shifting. And just because you don't spend money in this department, sometimes it, you wind up shifting costs to another department and things are more expensive. And in this case, I would just put this statistic before you, that according to a 2005 Department of Human Services study titled Financing Long-Term Care for Minnesota's Baby Boomers, at least 91% of the care that's delivered today is delivered by family members for the elderly, for their aging parents. And for every 1% of decline in that family supportive care, there's a $30 increase in public expenditures.
$30 million.
Yes, that would make more sense. $30 million expenditure. So while you might be trying to squeeze a balloon on the end that disallows employees to take care of their aging family member, it comes out again in another area in public expenditures for the elderly. So this would give people an opportunity to stay home that day, use their own sick leave according to the rules they've already negotiated, but just honestly be able to call into their bosses and say, I'd like to take the day off for my mother, and have that be a legitimate use of their sick leave time.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sympathetic to that, the cause or what is being attempted here, because I care for aging parents too. But I guess when I first heard of the bill, I thought it was only applicable to government employees. And to realize that it is also applicable to the private sector, which I know this division doesn't have to worry about. But if it was going to cost the state $11 million for its employees, we know that that fiscal note would be multiplied many times among the private sector. And that makes this a lot tougher decision. And I understand the cities and the counties, too, not maybe being exempted from it. So I don't know. But it's tough because I do realize that if you don't have a family member to take an elderly parent to a medical appointment, they have to call a Medicab or something, and they might get reimbursed from their insurance for that, or Medicare, or their insurance. And in general, that often costs us more. But I just don't know if it's fair to put this on the private employers. I would feel much more comfortable if it was only affecting those people within our control at this point.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, I think Heidi Holstein has had a conversation with the chamber about this, if you'd be reassured to hear her report.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not here speaking on behalf of the chamber, and earlier today I did see a representative from the chamber in the audience, but in the conversations that I've had with them in the past, they have said to me that many of the employers in Minnesota offer PTO time, paid time off or personal time off, so the sick leave vacation doesn't affect them. I would just like to add that further, the Federal Department of Human Services estimates that there are 610,000 family caregivers in Minnesota, and we estimate about at a maximum half of that number would be affected by this law, and that, I want to stress, is a maximum amount of people. So at the most, 300,000 people would be affected.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson. Since the issue of paid time off versus sick leave has come up, I'd like to comment on that issue. To make clear with the members what paid time off is versus sick leave is basically you adopt a policy where the employer says you have X amount of time to take for whatever you want, whether it's sickness, care for a relative, or vacation. We don't care. You make the determination of it. And those employers who have made that transition to it have seen a substantial reduction in their use of sick leave because there's no longer the incentive to take the so-called mental health days where they claim sick leave for what truly really is vacation, because the employee is much more cognizant that he or she is reducing their time off. most employers are trying to make the transition, or many employers, to paid time off. But placing this benefit on sick leave would be an impediment to doing that. So if you are going to be considering the policy, I ask you to take that into consideration as well.
And again, trying to get at the cost of this, Mr. Bonner, could you explain, do you have any, can you help us understand some of our collective bargaining, some are just policies, how do we sort this out?
Mr. Chairman, in the amendment, the exemption from the requirement does say that if an employer has a policy that authorizes the use of sick leave for these purposes, they're exempt from the requirements of the rest of the bill. And the Department of Employee Relations had testified that through policies and agreements that they had, they were able to, in effect, schedule the use of the sick leave to provide cost savings. I wondered if any of that applied to the local units of government as well.
If it's a collective bargaining agreement, that's a policy too? That's covered?
The amendment references both policies and a provision in the labor agreement.
Or a provision. Okay. Okay. Is there anybody else who wants to be heard on, again, focusing on the budgetary aspects of this bill before us today? Anybody else wants to be heard? Any discussion by the committee? Is there a motion?
I'll make that motion.
The Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 1128 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Finance. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. Okay. I'll just remind you, it is AARP Day on the Hill today, so thank you very much.
I've noticed. Okay, let's see. I see Senator Scully. Is Senator Metzen here as well, too? He's probably chairing his own budget division right now. So, mm-hmm. Senator Scully, I guess we can get to yours, and we'll try to see if where Senator Metzen is. Welcome back before the budget division, Senator Scully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here with Senate File number 3088, appropriation to help NPR continue on with digitizing the radio signal. I have to say, members, that at the time I signed this bill, I told them that this was the only general fund appropriation bill I was going to carry this year because I know of the tight budget times that we are facing. We have had a little health emergency in the animal industry, so that's no longer the case, but I do understand that times are going to be hard this year. But I also do know that this is ability to get federal matching monies for this conversion, and so therefore I would ask for your positive support on this bill. I'm here with Mr. Nelson and Ms. Wiggin, did I pronounce that right? Thank you, from NPR, and they would like to say a few words about this bill.
Welcome to the Budget Division.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Nelson. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Minnesota Public Radio. Before Lisa begins her testimony, I just wanted to acknowledge the budgetary challenge the state is facing. We understand there's very little, if any, funding available. The only reason we're approaching the state this year is that there's a guaranteed federal match for this one-time state investment, and those federal dollars have a short timeline. We feel that it is our responsibility as stewards of current and hopefully future state funding that we pursue any and all federal dollars that can match the state investment in Minnesota Public Radio. In that case, it means we're here before you today. With that, I'll introduce Lisa Wiggin.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Wiggin, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Lisa Wiggin. I am a volunteer for Minnesota Public Radio, and I am a chairperson of the Minnesota Public Radio Advisory Committee for the Brainerd area. I am here to ask you to support Minnesota Public Radio, and I want to give you my unbiased opinion that NPR is vital to me and to other thousands of citizens in greater Minnesota. It is our best source for statewide news and information and cultural programming, and it's really a great tradition, part of our civic engagement in our state, and it keeps us all informed about issues and ideas that matter to the citizens of Minnesota. NPR is asking for one-time, federally matched funds to complete its transition to a digital signal statewide. And much like public television, This transition is crucial to the future of public radio. Thanks to your past support and to federal matching funds, 17 NPR stations in Greater Minnesota have already been converted to digital. The appropriation I ask you to support would fund the remaining 12, and two of those stations are in Brainerd, KBPN at 88.3, KBPR at 90.7. A digital signal will provide Brainerd with better, more reliable service, and it is the first step towards increasing the programming offered by Minnesota Public Radio in Greater Minnesota. And you may ask, why does this matter? Well, a few years ago, Brainerd did not have a Minnesota Public Radio news station. So many of us really had to try to tune in NPR news station, which was coming from Collegeville. It usually involved duct tape and makeshift antennas, tinfoil. For some reason, one of my friends had to leave a microwave door open in order to get the news. So it was really a hardship. And not getting NPR news was really cutting us off, really, from the rest of the world and the rest of the state. No one else covers the news in Minnesota. No one provides more thorough coverage of what happens here at the Capitol. It's indispensable to those of us in Greater Minnesota that rely on public radio to connect us to what is happening throughout the state. I often travel around the state, and I can count on NPR everywhere I go for up-to-date news, weather, and entertainment while I do. NPR's regional coverage is an important part of why Minnesota Public Radio is so valuable to me. I moved to the Brainerd area 25 years ago from Robbinsdale, and I have to confess I was a little bit metrocentric. I was young and thought that civilization was disappearing in my rearview mirror as I drove north. However, much to my delight, I quickly learned there's much life beyond the metro area, and NPR is really one of the few ways that our outstate resources get publicized and understood. And I think that's good for rural economies, and it's good for tourism in Greater Minnesota. I would urge you to support Minnesota Public Radio's efforts to continue bringing high-quality public radio service to Greater Minnesota and to finish the digital conversion project they started last year. Thank you so much for the ability to testify here. I'd like to turn it over to Jeff Nelson from Minnesota Public Radio for the details.
Thank you, Ms. Wigan. I think Senator Rest would tell us there's a lot of good things in Robbinsdale, too. So.
Yes, there are.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
And for Senator Pappas,
Ms. Wigan, did you go to Robbinsdale High School?
I did.
So we'll talk later about when you graduated.
Okay.
When I graduated.
A long time ago.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Nelson. And members of the committee, again, my name is Jeff Nelson. I work for NPR. I also live and work here in St. Paul. I'll just give you a brief overview of our digital conversion project, and then both Lisa and I can answer any questions that you may have. Minnesota Public Radio reaches approximately 850,000 Minnesotans weekly through our three daily radio services. Those listeners tune in on average 8.5 hours a week. In Greater Minnesota, our audience is about 250,000 listeners, and we employ about 350 people around the state. Throughout the years, NPR has worked diligently to maintain, improve, and expand our radio service in Greater Minnesota. This includes 29 stations from Duluth to Fergus Falls, Grand Rapids, Grand Marais, Thief River Falls, Bemidji, Brainerd, Moorhead, and the list goes on and on. This summer, thanks to the support of the state of Minnesota, NPR will begin broadcasting from a new wide area service in the Roseau-Warroad region. Digital conversion is the single largest capital project Minnesota Public Radio has undertaken in Greater Minnesota. Our goal is to provide the entire state with the same digital service that is now available in the Twin Cities. It will improve the underlying infrastructure of our entire network, provide high-quality audio to listeners with digital receivers, and eliminate many interference issues in areas that currently have a marginal analog signal. This legislature appropriated $2 million during last year's session, for which we have received $2 million in federal matching funds. Together, this has paid for the digital conversion of 17 Greater Minnesota stations. We are requesting the final $1 million from the state to be matched by the federal government and used to complete the digital conversion of the remaining 12 stations in Greater Minnesota. This will include stations in Appleton, Brainerd, the Buell, Virginia, and Hibbing area, Fergus Falls, Grand Marais, and Thief River Falls. This is one-time federally matched funding to complete the digital conversion of all NPR stations. We estimate the total cost of digital conversion for NPR stations will be about $6.9 million, $6 million of which will be spent in Greater Minnesota. We hope to receive $3.1 million in federal matching funds. NPR uses its technical infrastructure across the state for important services in addition to its radio programming. There are four services uniquely provided by NPR. With its network of stations, Minnesota Public Radio serves as the backbone of the state's emergency alert system, commonly referred to as EAS and formerly known as the Emergency Broadcast System. NPR provides the signals in the event of an emergency to all other radio stations, television stations, and cable providers across Minnesota. NPR also plays an important role in the safety of our most important resource, our children, by serving as the radio backbone of the state's Amber Alert system, providing Amber Alerts to all other radio stations, television stations, and cable providers across Minnesota. Minnesota Public Radio also serves as provides the special subcarrier signals for the Radio Talking Book, a reading service offered by the Minnesota State Services for the Blind. Since 1968, the Radio Talking Book service has broadcast readings of current print newspapers, books, and periodicals for those unable to read print publications themselves. In addition, NPR serves as the sole backup network operations center for national public radio in our country's and our country's public radio satellite system. In the event of an emergency or disaster in Washington, Minnesota Public Radio here in St. Paul would take over operations of the entire national network. We are very grateful for the public-private collaboration that has made Minnesota Public Radio what it is today. We look forward to expanding our mission of public service well into the future. Thank you for your time and attention. If you have any questions, we're here.
I just want to check Mr. Lundeen, our fiscal analyst. You talked about the $2 million last year, and it says you requested $3.8. Could you just kind of, Mr. Lundeen, just run us through what happened last year in the process?
Okay. Well, the process, as the bill moved out of the Senate, we had $2.5 million in the bill. And then once we got to conference committee, I believe we agreed upon $3 million. And as you recall, that bill was vetoed by the governor. So then coming back with the bill that was signed by the governor, it was the $2 million that was put in there for the digital conversion.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Of the witnesses or Sarah Scully? Is there anybody else who's here on this issue? Well, Sarah Scully, you know the situation as well as I do, but is there a motion on what to do here? So the bill is already in the Finance Committee, so regardless of whether we do anything, it's still there. So maybe without recommendation or just what do you want to do?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to give it a recommendation to pass, even though I know it might be an uphill battle, but
yeah. Okay, Senator Kubley moves that Senate File 3088 be recommended to pass to the Finance Committee. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Scully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Good luck.
Mr. Chair, I can prove beyond a reasonable doubt we're in a recession. This was the only can of Diet Coke I could find in the Republican caucus, therefore proving we have a recession. Small cans of Diet Coke.
I don't think we have any.
Exercise to shrink your stomach.
Apparently, Senator Metz is on his way for Senate File 2620.
That Coke probably died on a tie.
Nobody asked for a division. Well, Sarah Pappas is over there, too, so, yeah. So.
Yeah, but I think three of us voted.
No, I voted yes. We can put it in the mix.
I could.
I must be getting old. I find myself listening to public radio all the time. And then AARP keeps sending me those messages to sign up. It's just an age thing.
How much money did they win?
A million. Well, yeah. Duh.
I don't know. Well,
but Cohen cares about those kind of issues, so.
But you think you'll find a million?
No. No. You know what? I don't know.
Maybe sell it out to a private company.
NPR has got a lot of money.
Solve the budget. Yeah. That great? Put that in the notes. Put in a good public radio system, get all the digital conversion. Maybe we can sell it to the highest offer to make this fix the budget. The whole
thing. Who is that speaking?
Making a profit. Always thinking about the future.
Let's go into recess for a minute until we'll send a message. But we're in recess. And compensation plans ratification. Senator Metzl, welcome to the budget.
Thank you, Chairman Betzel. I think you've only heard this twice so far, but this will be your third time to listen.
I've been on every stop so far. Senator Roebling, have you been on?
You
were on the first stop, so I've heard it every step of the way so far. So go ahead.
Yeah, we've, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is the ratification bill for the state, most of the state employees, and I'll get into that in a minute, but this has gone through the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, passed there unanimously. Senator Olson is on that, Senator Betzel, Senator Metzen, Senator Scheid, and Senator Wergen, and, of course, a like amount of members in the House. But, again, this is the – and it went through last week, the full committee of Senator Rest's committee, too. So now we got this stop, and then I imagine the full Finance Committee later, and then hopefully take it to the floor. But – again, it's had a couple of stops. It's been ratified by the Department of Employee Relations. What we're dealing with today, I believe, is about 11 of the 14 contracts. I might be off by one or two there, but we're pretty close. They all amount to pretty close to 3.25 a year, and I'll get into which ones have settled. And, of course, there's no... The money comes from the department's money they have on hand today. So my understanding, there's no additional appropriations. They take it out of their hide or what they were appropriated for last year. So that's where it comes from.
As members will remember, last year all the budget bills had a
3%
pay increase of 3%. And then the contracts came back and settled for 3.25%. So they settled for a higher number than was appropriated, but it's my understanding that it comes out, the agencies are going to have to pay for it and are planning to do it.
Senator Betzel, that's what I understand, that they've agreed that, you know, there's no new appropriations from the Senate or the legislature to fund that 0.25. So I'll just tell you, subdivision one, deals with AFSCME, Council 5. There's about 16,200 clerical employees there. MAPE is the next one, 11,400 folks. AFSCME 5 and Unit 8, about 1,900. That's in the corrections area. AFSCME, Council 15. These are radio communication officers. There's not many of them. I think about 69. State Residential Schools Education Association, 180 folks there. Government engineers contract, 880. Middle management, 2,750. The commissioner's plan, 1,100. And the managerial plan, 1,260. I think we've got a deal. We've got a couple, Mr. Chairman and members, kind of hanging out there, including the Minskew and maybe my. We could, but I think I think they're going to ratify that hopefully this weekend. And who else is out there?
Mr. Huebinger, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Huebinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. As Senator Metzen mentioned, there are tentative agreements with two other unions, the State University faculty and the Minnesota State College faculty at the two-year institutions. The subcommittee it would be intending to meet in the next week or so to review those contracts and to forward its recommendation and perhaps amend this bill when it's in full finance.
Senator Metzen, would you also want to comment on Section 1 of the bill, which talks about the salary cap for the zoo director?
Yeah, thank you. Just going to get to that. This is a little unusual, Mr. Chairman. It lifts the cap on the Minnesota Zoo director's salary. Trust me, we're not going to make a habit of this, but we've got, of the 12 or 15 zoos we checked on across the nation. We are the lowest paid, our zoo director is the lowest paid zoo director that we could find out of the 12 or 14 top zoos. And we figure we're in the top with the new grizzly expansion out there and the type of zoo that we have, that we're in that category. And I don't want to lose this guy. He's wonderful, and it's Lee Emke's his name. He does a wonderful job. And this additional dollars is no state tax dollars at all. They've got a very, very active foundation, extremely active zoological foundation out there, and they raise literally millions of dollars for the exhibit. And they're willing to stick whatever it takes to keep this director in. So thank you for asking me to bring that up. But again, as chair of this LCC Employee Relations Committee, this is not going to be a habit, but in this case, I think it's essential. If I had my druthers, I'd lift the cap on lots of, we're missing out on some good city managers and in other areas, but so be it. That's what it is today, but that's part of this.
Okay. Is there anybody else who wants to be heard on the bill? Senator Oakland, you're doing
it. Well, Mr. Chair, I have some concerns in light of the budget deficit that we have, that we're taking this up right now until we see some solutions for how we're going to resolve the deficit. And so I was thinking of making a motion to table this bill because for both reasons, both from the state perspective of how we're going to resolve the deficit, but also once we have a plan, I would think it would be an advantage to the unions to look at that. And if they realize that all these cuts are going to be made throughout the agencies and throughout employee staffing, maybe they would just as soon like to figure out how to keep some of their fellow union members' jobs, and that might entail having the flexibility to have this pot of money divided differently. And so I don't know. I mean, maybe they don't think that way, but I would be concerned about that. That if we're either going to start cutting a lot of jobs, if there's no flexibility, that's the only option we have.
Well, I respect your remarks there, but this is these have been worked on for about 8-10 months, and it's a long, long, tedious, tough process, and to get everybody to agree, management, so to speak, and labor, and this is a tough, tough situation. But trust me, and I'm not part of it, but I know what they went through, and to kind of say forget it and it's over, we got to wait. I think that would be doing a disservice to the hard work and the people that ratified this and in good conscience and good, so I don't know what else to tell you. It just didn't just happen. This was carefully worked out, and to get these people to agree is it's hard to do.
Yeah, Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, but Senator Metzen, when they did work on this, and I know it goes back a long ways, probably started almost like a year ago, we still had a surplus back then. And so this was negotiated under somewhat different circumstances than was just revealed to us last Thursday. And so that's my concern.
Yeah, I understand. And maybe we're coming at this. First of all, I understand $1 billion is a lot of money. But we got a $37 billion budget, and it just seems to me this is manageable without tax increases. We're not going to raise taxes. And I'm told by the departments we can handle this, even with the and a billion's a lot, but when you put it in the big frame of the $38 billion budget, I think we can, Senator Betzel and you guys are going to take some hits. I know in your division, and everybody's going to take some hits, but I don't want to dismantle something that we've worked so hard on, and it's going to work.
And keep in mind, I mean, this covers a lot of areas that are beyond this budget division, and even if we tabled it, the bill is actually sitting in the Finance Committee, so the Finance Committee can bring it up for a hearing whenever the Finance Committee wants to bring it up for a hearing. So, we don't kill bill. We hear them on behalf of the Finance Committee, but they ultimately decide when to hear it. I do have a question, though, and maybe Dewar can respond to this. What is the process or what happens if, for whatever reason, the legislature does not ratify the contract? If we have some concerns, as Senator Roebling is raised, and for whatever reason it doesn't happen, then what's the next step then overall for these contracts?
Mr. Hubinger said he can take a shot at that.
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair, if the legislature fails to ratify the contracts, the contracts are voided, and the increases that are provided in the contracts are terminated, and employees go back to their old salaries. The messy part involves what happens with the health insurance benefits that had some significant changes this year. The health plans and the carriers and the clinics have all changed their billing system based on these contracts, and if these contracts are voided, it's not clear how that system would be affected.
So the now the pay raises that were appropriated last year, those are already being paid out right now. Is that correct?
Or Mr. Chair, for the contracts in this bill that were given interim approval by the subcommittee, right, those increases are in effect now.
Okay. So if for whatever reason the legislature didn't act on this, the pays would revert to what it had been previously. Is that how it works out? Okay.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I just feel that ratifying these contracts with the deficit we have is going to result in more unemployment, which is about the last thing that we need during a recession. And so so today, if we can't table it, I guess I'm going to vote no, because I just feel that we should have more options available for us as we try to keep employees on staff and deal with the budget cuts that we know are forthcoming. And so I don't necessarily want to take people all the way back to where they were, but 3.25% is maybe more than we can afford and keep people on staff. And so I guess that's my concern right now.
Well, and it's a good concern, Senator Roebling. I think, Senator, the governor's recommendations are going to come out for the budget on Friday, and, he may very well be asking the agencies to, do some reductions, but that's going to have to take, these raises into consideration. So I guess we'll see what his proposals are, then it's our turn to do something on them. But we have to go in that sequence. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 2620? There is to be none. Is there a motion?
Ask for your approval.
Sure. Thanks. Is there a motion?
I'll make that motion.
Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 2620 be recommended and passed to the Finance Committee. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Edson.
Thank you very kindly, Chairman, okay. Members.
In the last item on our agenda, I'd ask the Governor's Office to give us an update on the interagency agreements. This is a process, as you may know, by which the and this is not unique to I don't think it's unique to this governor's office, but typically the governors work with the agencies to try to bring people from the agencies into the governor's office to get some expertise, and it's going to change depending upon the desires and wills of a particular governor, but it is something that we have an interest in. And you have a document here that first there's a letter from Mr. Schroeder, the Deputy Chief of Staff, increasing the pay to 60% of each policy advisor salary fringe benefits. And then there's on the back, it actually shows which individuals and from which agencies are working through the governor's office on these issues. So, Mr. Schroeder, welcome to the Budget Division, and we'll need to have you identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bob Schroeder. I'm Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Pawlenty. Joining me today is Paula Brown, who heads up the operations section of our office. You've asked for a short discussion on interagency agreements.
Yep.
As I've testified before to this committee, interagency agreements are a useful tool in the executive branch to utilize resources and services across the administration for a variety of activities. Our office, past governors, the Attorney General's office, and I'm sure others rely on these agreements to provide services to state agencies. This is an especially useful tool for the chief executive, whose job includes providing the leadership needed to identify new statewide interests, coordinating the activities of the relevant state agencies, and bringing together the resources needed to pursue a particular objective. This is especially important when the issues cut across many different agencies. For an enterprise like Minnesota State Government with 40,000 employees and annual expenditures of $28 billion, all funds, we need to rely on the tools possible to serve, all the tools possible to serve the 5.2 million Minnesotans who rely on us. Some examples include addressing the complex issues associated with sex offenders and, for example, the reentry of our soldiers who have been serving overseas. From the perspective of the legislature, the most relevant use of interagency agreements includes the activities of our legislative and cabinet affairs staff. These folks are subject matter experts in particular areas and work closely with you in the legislature and state agencies. They manage the governor's policy and budget agendas and are your primary contact with our office. An important part of their role is to work with you on your agenda and that of the governor. In the last biennium, over 8,000 bills were introduced in the House and Senate, with nearly 300 of them becoming law. Many of the 8,000, I'm sure, were consolidated into the 300. For example, for this particular committee, combined, you are the chief authors of over 600 pieces of legislation, and I'm sure that if you included co-authorship, that number would probably double. Each of you is interested in passing these bills, of course, and I'm sure that you would value the governor's support in that quest. Well, it's our legislative and cabinet affairs folks who are key to that support.
Thank you.
From your perspective, it's important to know that these are the individuals that the governor trusts to fully examine the legislation that you propose to pass before it reaches his desk for final consideration. They also help to oversee the implementation of cabinet agency initiatives, many of which are created by the legislature and in concert with the governor's office. Another area where the interagency agreements are used is in the operation of the Federal Affairs Office in Washington, D.C. Minnesota receives over $7.1 billion annually from the federal government. For this reason, it's crucial that we maintain a close contact with the Minnesota congressional delegation, executive branch agencies of the federal government, and the White House. Likewise, we work very closely with many other states on national issues, especially now that the governor is chair of the National Governors Association. Some examples of where we have tried to protect and advance Minnesota's interests include funding for the I-35W bridge, the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, LIHEAP funding, the nationalizing of the Minnesota's Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program, which we are especially proud of and hoping to take beyond our own state borders. And, for example, also today, the governor's in Washington before the International Renewable Energy Conference, where he announced a report on the comparable performance of E-20 to E-10, and will be advocating to the federal government that they consider using it more broadly. You've asked for some specific data on our use of interagency agreements, which is covered in the two-sided handout that you now have. I'll direct your attention to side one, which is titled Governor's Office Interagency Agreement History by Activity. It has a big A in the bottom right corner. This details the specific uses of the interagency agreements. As I mentioned, this is predominantly focused on legislative and cabinet affairs activities and our federal affairs office. The dollar figures represent the amount of resources provided by interagency agreements to support the activities that are outlined in the most left-hand column. So, for example, in 2005, at the top, we created the state sex offender coordinator position, which was funded through interagency agreements. In 2007, that position was vacant for a period of time, so the funding was reduced. In 2008, the position now is assigned to the Department of Corrections and is funded through interagency agreements with Corrections, Human Services, and the Department of Public Safety. You've also asked for information about the agencies who participate in these agreements, and the second side of the document I've given out to you, titled the Governor's Office Interagency Agreement History by Agency, has a big B on the bottom right corner, is where you'll see the information that you've requested. It's by column. It's FY04, then the percent total that each of those interagency agreements represent for that fiscal year, all the way across to 2008. And then, of course, the agencies are listed along the left-hand side. And as you might expect, Human Services, Education, and Transportation, our largest state agencies, represent the biggest users. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments. I'm happy to stand for questions.
Yeah, I've got just a couple of questions here. First of all, the Lieutenant Governor had been just drawing the her salary as the MnDOT Commissioner and foregoing
her.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yeah.
The Lieutenant Governor has been always funded at the statutorily required position amount of Lieutenant Governor.
Okay.
Even as she served as Commissioner of Transportation.
Okay. So. So not now is it, but she wasn't being paid twice. Of course, she was just being drawing the one salary. So
that's correct.
So now it's going to be a MnDOT salary that's going to have to be paid for a new MnDOT Commissioner. Is that?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just to be clear, the Lieutenant Governor, there was an interagency agreement for a period of time in 06, 07, and a portion of this fiscal year, an interagency agreement between our office and MnDOT for funding of the activities of the Lieutenant Governor as related to her duties as Commissioner of Transportation. That interagency agreement and those obligations were concluded last week.
Right. So does that is that going to affect any of the budgeting of the governor's office then? I mean, you're going to have to – would cost you more than
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we made adjustments to recognize and accommodate that.
Okay. I've had a question. Now, the Faith and Community Coordinator, this is somebody paid by DHS, Corrections, Vets, and Housing, and is this now – Could explain a little bit more
That position. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you look in the bottom of side A, note B at the bottom, the position was created in 2006, was fully funded by the governor's office. In 2008, it became funded just recently through interagency agreements with those particular agencies. There's a lot of, very broadly, I think we all can appreciate the strong value of faith and community service organizations to deliver services of our that our citizens need. The answers don't always have to rest with government. I'm sure we all appreciate that. The governor's view is that it was important to harness the resources and interests of those communities to try and help those folks in need on a more coordinated basis led from a position within our office. As I said, it was created in 2006, fully funded in our office. We recently changed that to acknowledge that a new focus, a greater focus now, is as it relates to the needs of our returning soldiers. The agencies here represent the kind of services that many of those individuals will need. So we've accommodated for that in respect. But I also want to be absolutely clear as well. The legislature has been kind enough to grant us carry-forward authority in previous biennial budgets, and last year was as well. In the past, though, that that authority was much more broadly focused and allowed agencies to a significant amount of discretion. The recent carry-forward authority was narrowly focused to technology needs. Our office is relatively limited in terms of its technology needs, so the opportunity for us to utilize the carry-forward authority is very, very limited. So as a consequence, we've had to consider different approaches to our budget.
And then, you know, you delivered a letter to my office just explaining the percentage of your how much is being paid to the agencies. Could you just explain what this means? And I mean, just for people who may not understand what it is.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have an obligation under the law to provide you and the appropriate committee chair, Representative Kahn, in the House with information when interagency agreements are altered or updated. And this letter was a result of an alteration that specifically was related to the Faith and Community Services activity, correct?
And just translating it, when you went from 50% to 60%, What does that mean? I mean, just so that we understand.
Sure. The total cost of the in this particular case, mostly the Legislative and Cabinet Affairs, their total interagency agreement. Excuse me, their combined cost of that activity was accommodated through interagency agreements at about a 50% level. Because of a variety of needs, it was now moved up to 60%.
And you could theoretically go to 100% if. If you needed to do that, is that correct? I mean, there's no statutory cap as to how
I'm not aware of any, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Schroeder,
I don't think I've ever seen such an extensive use of interagency agreements to staff the governor's office. I mean, with charging the agency 60% of the cost now up from 50%, what is the governor doing with the money he's saving? I mean, what is he, you know, who else is working in the governor's office now, or has he just cut his budget down and shifted it all over, all the cost of his office over to all the state agencies?
Mr. Shorter?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I don't know about your experience with other interagency agreements. As I think I've said, they're not an uncommon practice in the executive branch. For example, the Attorney General's office is the most, the highest user by a substantial factor. I think last year their interagency agreements with agencies were well over almost $11 million.
Mr. Shorter, let me just say, though, that in that case, the lawyers from the AG's office are providing kind of legal services to the state agency. In this case, they're really not providing any services. These staff people are not providing services to the agency. They're providing services to the governor.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and
where
Senator.
The agency is paying for it.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator, our view is different than that. The distinction may be very frankly modest between the Attorney General's staff services and our office. They are services. We provide budgetary services, policy services, including legal services at times, to state agencies and interact with them routinely. When you put together a budget the size that we do with as many employees that we have, there's a fair amount of coordination and activity that has to take place to ensure that the agencies are addressing the needs that the governor views to be most important and that the governor is aware and addressing the needs of the agencies also deemed to be as important.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Schroeder, my other question was, then what's the governor doing with all the money he's saving? You know, what other staff people are working for the governor that we're not even aware of?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, we have roughly the same complement headcount as we've had since the governor first took office. Our office is divided into three main functional areas. Different cabinet affairs, as I mentioned, the subject matter experts that work with the legislature and the agencies. We have communication staff as the second major area that also includes constituent services, citizen outreach. There are many instances every day of citizens who are have particular needs and they really don't know where else to turn, so they call the first on the list, which would be the governor's office, so we try and serve their needs. And then the third part of our office includes operations, but I would not say that we're necessarily saving money. We're employing it to serve the governor's agenda and the citizens.
Other questions? If not, well, thank you, Mr. Shorter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
I appreciate the opportunity to hear about this.
Yes, okay. Thank you so much.
Okay, then next week, Kathleen, what do we do next week?
Overview of the governor's budget.
Okay, governor's budget comes out on Friday, and so we'll have our... We'll be looking at our portion of that when it comes out. So, okay, nothing further. Meeting adjourned.
It will seem pretty.
Upstairs.